wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning sandwich station carries no news of the world.
So where's the news of the people left out? Put a camera in my face just to hear me shout. But they don't want to hear what I shout about. You love it when we're cuff, but not a people rebuff. We never play the lead in the sitcom you call the news. Unless we're accused, positive reviews. The born unschooled, mostly dope. But it's the inside dope that holds the hope. Can't cope with the selling of news like toothpaste. Spitting out.
That's the song News Goo. And by Polarity One, about our news industry and business. And that's become the focus of this program, was News Dissector Radio, is now Media Channel Radio, an outgrowth and in a sense, a platform of MediaChannel.org, which is an online media issues network. It's been going since 2002, and we're happy to be on PRN with an audio version, speaking to some of the people in the media who can offer insights and can help us understand better what's going on. Not just people in the media, but people who interact with the media, who observe the media, who have in-depth knowledge of the stories that the media is covering. Mort of MediaChannel.org is joining me now. Are you there, Mort?
I am here.
Well, what do you know? Some technology is just brilliant here, and we're happy to have you here. We're going to be talking about two of the main foreign policy crises that are underway right now. One of them is what's happening in the Ukraine and the Crimea, Russia's role there, America's response to it, and how it's being covered in the media. Are we getting a fair representation of the various views, and or is there, once again, in times of war and conflict, a news that tends to reinforce the views of those in power, reinforce American perspectives over perspectives from other countries? Joining us to discuss that in a minute is Raymond McGovern. Ray McGovern, who was a retired CIA officer turned political activist. He was a CIA analyst from 1963 to 1990. And in the 1980s, chaired the National Intelligence Estimates, prepared the president's daily brief. He received the Intelligence Commendation Medal on his retirement, but more significantly, in his retirement, he's co-founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and can now speak out about the CIA. At 5:30 in the second half hour of this program, we're going over to England to talk with Lee Salter, an academic in the UK focusing on journalism, media, political economy, and political theory. He's also a specialist who's been very interested in and written quite a bit about developments in Venezuela. So that's the focus of our program here. We want to welcome you to it. We hope that you'll stay with us. We also hope that you will check out MediaChannel.org. Just one announcement. Our program last week with Matt Cecil, author of a book about the FBI, an excerpt from that book is now online at MediaChannel.org, the introduction, which talks about not only the role of the FBI in campaigning to try to control media coverage, but also the why the media tends to work with the government the way it does. And that's the focus of this particular effort. So you can check that out online, and you'll find a lot of other articles of interest about what's happening in and to and through our media. But now we go down to Washington, D.C. Hopefully Ray McGovern is there. Are you there, Ray?
I am, Vinny.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. And Ray McGovern is somebody who has followed this story for a long time because he's an expert, am I right, Ray, on Russia, that you speak Russian, that you reported on Russia, and you know a lot about the background to this crisis in the Ukraine.
Yeah, actually, Danny, I was immersed in it during my undergraduate and my graduate studies at Fordham at a time when they had a very thriving Russian center. So this brings back a lot of memories that are not just, academic. These are strategic memories that put the whole thing in some sort of context that I think is missing from most of the mainstream media.
Well, knowing what you know, which is a whole lot, okay, and certainly a whole lot more than I do or most Americans, what kind of story are we getting through our media, the media that you read and see, and what's missing from it?
Well, What we're getting is Putin very bad. Ukrainians striving for identification with the West, very good. Other Ukrainians who are used to cooperating with Russians, very bad. And we want the IMF and the World Bank and the Wall Street banks to be able to teach these, at least Western Ukrainians, that their future is with us. All they have to do is lots of austerity measures. And we have a new interim prime minister now that will enforce those austerity measures. He's promised to do that publicly. He's promised to commit what he called, quote, political suicide, end quote, in doing this. And so there will be a first supply of low-cost workers coming our way into Western and Eastern Europe. And all we have to do is make sure that people like the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and our ambassador there in Kiev, and the National Endowment for Democracy, which, of course, carries the mantle that once was borne by the CIA covert action folks, will get this thing stirred up to a point where we'll embarrass bad Putin. We'll sort of slide at least most of the Ukraine into Europe. And by the way, wouldn't it be nice to have them as part of NATO as well? You know, just to give us a little edge of this of defense against this.
Well,
very
I hate to say it, but I detect a certain amount of sarcasm here, Ray. And I'm going to bring Mort in a second with some questions, because we've been covering all of this or trying to disentangle the different narratives that are in the media. But we should say about this acting prime minister, Mr. Arseniy Yatsenyuk, is a former foreign minister, an economics minister, a speaker of parliament, an acting central bank chief. Moreover, he has a great nickname, the Rabbit. So the Rabbit met yesterday in the White House, so the other day, with President Obama, who couldn't say enough nice things about him, pledging American support for the Ukraine. There seems to be a little problem over in Congress in ratifying the aid package that the United States wants to offer, because it requires some sort of restraint on the role of the IMF. Or focus on the role of the IMF that Republicans, particularly Tea Party Republicans, have an ideological objection to. So they haven't worked out how to get that through Congress and get the money to the Ukraine. But the United States is making noises about diplomacy. We need to solve this diplomatically, says the president, says the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Dempsey. We are ready for war. So those are the two voices that are coming out of Washington. Your take on this, Mort?
Well, I'd like to ask Ray, given his background for many, many years in covering the region and the geopolitics of the Cold War and post-Cold War, what's transpired between the EU and Russia and the Ukraine since the wall has come down? And I'd like to ask you for a historical context that places the current conflict in that context, so we could better understand it.
Yeah, well, the most salient aspect is that Ukraine has had no tradition of democracy. They have no experience, really, in ruling themselves. They've always been ruled by someone else, half of the country by one country and half by the other. And so rampant corruption was the byword no matter what government came into Ukraine after the dissolution of the Soviet Union.
Just on that point, Ray, I mean, I've read comparisons of the Ukraine to the Central African Republic in terms of being up there on the list of the most corrupt countries in the world.
Yeah. Well, it's a real problem because Ukraine has all manner of natural resources. They've got the black soil to grow things. They're the wheat basket for the rest of Russia. And so it's not like they need to be in that impoverished category. So then there's kind of the, I suppose, since you asked me, I will try to put a historic brace on this thing. People don't realize that the Russians have this one great big inferiority complex. And there's ample reason for that, and it's historic. It's historical, I should say. The Slavs, you know, now represented by the Russians, Ukrainians, and the Belarusians, in the 9th century after Christ, okay, they had no language. They had no written language. They had no alphabet. They had a rich oral tradition, but no written language. And so, you know, this is, what, 2-3 millennia after the Greeks and the Romans and the Hebrews and the Egyptians. Anyhow, two Greek priests, Cyril and Methodius, decided, you know, these are nice people. Let's construct a language for them. And they did. And they used words from, they would use letters from Greek and from Latin and from Hebrew, and a couple they had to construct themselves, okay? And all of a sudden, Kievan Rus, okay? Kievan Rus, which means, you know, Russia centered in Kiev in the 9th century, they got a language. And they used it for their church liturgies, and then they used it for their literature, and because you know, Russian literature has just flourished, okay? And at the same time, Knyaz Vladimir, Prince Vladimir decided, you know, it might be good for us all to become Christians. That seems to be an you know, educated thing to do. So he dipped all his subjects in the Dnieper River, and all of a sudden, Kievan Rus became Greek Orthodox, Greek Christians. Now, the next thing that happened was, you know, very sorrowful, because as they started to become a country, all of a sudden they're invaded by Genghis Khan, you know, from the east, right? And that was two and a half centuries, you know, 1200s to 1450, around there. And so, well, Europe was coming out of the Dark Ages, okay, and into the Renaissance. The Russians were still fighting off these, the Zolotaya Orda, the Golden Hordes, okay? And then when they finally got rid of them, the Swedes and the Lithuanians and the Poles were really at them from the West. So, Ivan the Terrible and the others in the 15th century finally consolidated things. All of a sudden you get Peter the Great, who comes in around 1700, and he says, yeah, we ought to westernize this place. And they do. Catherine the Great comes in at the end of that century, and she extends the unified Moscow-centered Russia down to the Black Sea to include Crimea, which was even then the center of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, which was a fairly good fleet, okay? Now,
plus great beaches, right?
What's
great
that?
Beaches also, right?
I heard. I've never been in the beaches. So just to finish up here, so they're getting, you know, this is about the time we're having a revolution, our own revolution, American Revolution. Catherine the Great, you know, gets things pretty much together. And all of a sudden, Napoleon appears, and he decides it might be fun to invade Russia. And so they suffer that. And then as they're getting over that, you know, a century later, or you know the story, Hitler goes in. Now, the Russians lost they lost 26 million people in World War II, okay? They bore the brunt of what the Nazis did. We didn't come in big time until, as you know, June 6, 1944. We were in North Africa, Italy, yeah. But it was the Russians that beat them back from Volgograd, from Kursk, and the other places. And they lost 26 million people, okay? So they feel real strongly about that. Why do I mention that? Because there were a whole bunch of Ukrainians that were fellow travelers with the Nazis. There were a whole bunch of Ukrainians who not only assisted, but went out of their way to round up Jews, Poles, whatever the Nazis didn't like, and they were just as vicious as the SS or the Gestapo ever was. Russians remember that, okay? And Ukrainians remember that, especially the ones that live out in the eastern part of Ukraine. And so one of the very sorrowful things about this whole experience is that there are neo-Nazi, that there are hard-right people of real disrepute who are responsible largely for taking over some of these demonstrations that started as very popular ones. And we know from some intercepted telephone conversations that at one point snipers were doing a great job, but they were shooting at both sides, you know. Somebody wanted to stir up the masses, And, of course, that is what led to the overthrow of the duly constituted government, however corrupt he was, of Yanukovych. And here we are now in a situation where Putin's not going to put up with this. And whoever was advising Kerry and saying, well, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy can spend $100 million on 65 projects in Ukraine, and Victoria Nuland can talk about, you know, that conversation she had with the U.S. ambassador in Kiev is a classic. She's saying, yachts. She didn't have any take the trouble to know how to pronounce Yatsenyuk, right? Yats is our guy. The other fellows, well, they can wait in the wings. They can come in later, but Yats is our guy. And Yats, of course, is the Yatsenyuk, who you mentioned before, who headed the central bank and other things. Now, one would have thought that once that was on YouTube, that the Ukrainians, the U.S., all the people that wanted to have it ostensible, the new government, not subservient to the West, would not have picked Yats. But, you know, as I said in one piece, right, yikes, it's Yats. And where was he yesterday? At the White House. And then he's, you know, talking to the Atlantic Council and all this stuff. So, you know, I was tempted to sort of, you know, write off and say, you know, Obama can't be this stupid. But he's under a lot of pressure, and with all the media saying Putin bad, Yats good, you know, that's not good. And,
well, you know, it's the whole thing in American foreign policy. You know, who lost China, who lost Vietnam, mm-hmm. now who lost Ukraine, and of course, you know, Sarah Palin has weighed in here, denouncing Obama for not intervening in Georgia when, in fact, Obama wasn't in office yet. But little errors like that don't get in the way of a strong ideological statement. But, you know, your historical rundown here, is fascinating and, of course, not really covered. This context is not presented very well in our media, which is part of the reason we wanted your reactions to what you're reading in the press. I mean, you know, obviously you've focused on the details of all of this and great detail, classified and unclassified, whatever. But are the American people able to understand and decode what's going on here based on what they're reading and seeing, in your view?
The bad news, Danny, is no, they're not. They have to take the extra trouble to get on websites like your own or others that do have good information. The good news is that even so, they don't want another involvement of this kind. And I saw a poll 2 days ago that said something like only like 24% of the American people thought we ought to be strong on Ukraine, and 56% said let's not get involved in another one of these things. So there is a basic effect of what we did vis-a-vis Iraq and Afghanistan. We saw it blossom right before we almost did the same thing to Syria. And the reason it was almost and not the real thing is because Americans are waking up here, and they certainly don't want another war. So if you're looking for a solution here, I've been promoting this line for the last 3 days, and, you know, intelligence officers usually don't promote policy, but heck, I'm retired, right? When Putin sent those troops in or reinforced the troops in the Crimea and scheduled this referendum, well, that's a bargaining chip, you know? The thing's not until Sunday. I noticed that Kerry and Lavrov are going to meet tomorrow. Well, you know, the chip's on the table. If Putin says to Lavrov, look, tell Kerry, you know, if you back off, if you give up any notion of consolidating Ukraine into NATO or the EC, you know, we'll make a gesture and pull our troops out of the Crimea. We don't need them there. I mean, there are enough people already there. And then you can claim, you know, it's sort of like the Cuba Missile Crisis. We gave Khrushchev, we took those missiles out of Turkey, and he could crow about that. And, of course, he took his missiles out of Cuba. You have to work these things out. Now, the problem is Kerry has shown himself to be a classic neocon. He wanted war with Syria. And so the fact that Obama has to depend on this weak reed here to make sensible diplomacy, which is what we need, that's a real sort of an arm tied behind Obama's back. And unless he can get together personally with Putin, which is what happened on Syria. You know, Kerry said, well, Syria will never give up its chemical weapons. I mean, they're not going to do that. And what do you know? It's that same day, because Putin and Obama were talking about it, Lavrov got up, the Russian foreign minister, and said, yeah, we think they will give them up. 2 hours later, we did.
Mm-hmm. More, what's your reading of the press coverage here? I mean, it seems to be, kind of fanning the flames of war, but not totally. Maybe because the media itself doesn't really understand what's happening.
Well, what I find very fascinating is the usage of the term "we" in the press coverage. That our press has taken it upon themselves and seemingly thinks of themselves as an interested party. Rather than just conveying what's happening, there is a position of which they are a party to, that they themselves are taking aside and looking at things and saying, oh, we ought to do this, we ought to do that, rather than saying they're doing this, they're doing that, and putting forward the context that Ray was kind enough to give us historically and really mapping out a potential resolution to it, which is what I wanted to ask you, Ray. Is the referendum a bargaining chip? That's really Russia's play. You're making me think that there's really no scenario here that results in anything but a different segment of the Ukrainian elite allied with the EU, looking to revamp the economy along a neoliberal line. And just from the history, it makes it sound like every conceivable historical power in the region has pawed over these people and constructed them in a way absent their own self-determination. And economically, it seems like they're in a colonial formula, that they have their natural resources that are going to be exported rather than refined and produced and added value to domestically. Is there a scenario in which that does not happen, in which this new elite aligned with Europe doesn't come to power along with their coterie of fascist, neo-fascist, call them what you will? Is there any way that the democratic inclination and desires of the young protesters actually get played out in a meaningful way?
Really good questions, and I agree with the points that you make in asking those. I think there is, and you asked whether the occupation or the referendum about annexation or the drifting of Crimea back to Russia. I think it can be viewed as a bargaining chip, but our diplomacy, if it's even worth that label lately, doesn't seem to be sensitive to what could get them out of a very sticky situation. You know, I'm from the Bronx, and I think...
Yeah, okay.
When I say this, okay, now, we had these gangs sometimes, you know, and we weren't very nice kids when we were teenagers, and we used to, you know, do a little havoc in our own neighborhoods, but when we went to another neighborhood schoolyard, you know, we didn't do so well. But what I'm saying here is that no matter how strong NATO is, they're in a different schoolyard now. And Russian sensibilities need to be respected, because not only do they have this incredible inferiority complex, and they no longer have to feel that, but they still do, but they feel like they've been diddled, okay, to use another Bronx word. They were promised. They had 20 divisions, Soviet divisions in East Germany when the wall fell and when Gorbachev took power and the Soviet Union kind of dissolved. And they said, look, you know, we have 20 divisions. We're going to pull them out of East Germany. But look, do you have to make it part of West Germany? Oh, darn, you do. All right. Look, does it have to be part of NATO? Oh, darn. All right. Look, that's it. All right. That's where we put the limit. Don't even think about putting Poland or Romania or Bulgaria or Czechoslovakia into NATO. Okay, we got a deal? And Jim Baker, who was the Secretary of State for George H.W. Bush, said, you got a deal. Okay, now what happened? They pulled the troops out of East Germany. Nobody wanted a reunited Germany, least of all me, you know, the Russians. But it worked out okay. But the other stuff... It was a deception. It was a trick. Look how many members of NATO there are now. So what that's the background that Putin is bringing to this. I'm not going to be billed anymore. I'm not going to be tricked. We can work this out. Let's get together, all the stakeholders, and work out a deal where you're not going to put these guys in NATO, and we can work out a deal where we get a representative government that's different from the one now, but that all people can live with.
You know, I read somewhere, Ray McGovern, excuse me. I read somewhere, you know, that Putin gave to the Security Council all kinds of classified files of intelligence that they were collecting on not only what the U.S. was doing, but with what Lithuania was doing, what Poland has been doing to support, you know, these Ukrainian right-wing, pro-market, pro-whatever politicians, and, you know, showing that there's been a pattern of interference, a very deep pattern of interference. And the U.S. response has been to talk about how separatism is terrible, how can you, you know, even allow a country to allow part of itself to be, you know, removed or amputated from the body of the country. Nobody's mentioned Kosovo in that context, you know, that the U.S. has supported secession when it's in our interest, or we perceive it to be in our interest. So, you know, it seems as if all of this language makes it very confusing for people to really follow the real game that's being played here.
That's right. And, you know, when you talk about Lithuania, you talk about Poland, well, that's a live wire. That's a hot wire for the Russians. I mentioned already that just when they got rid of the Mongol hordes in the 12th to middle of the 14th century, then came the Lithuanians and then came the Poles. And it was a masterful effort that they had beat them on the ice over Leningrad or St. Petersburg at that time. So there's a great deal of animosity. And with this, these people are regarded by the Russians as doing our bidding, you know, doing NATO's bidding. After all, they're part of NATO now, right? Well, that's trouble. And there's no need for all this unless you have this grandiose scheme where you want them to provide cheap labor for the rest of Europe, and then put them in a situation that the Greeks find themselves in now, where they have a hardly subsistence, and the richness that's in Ukraine is sacrificed to the international operations.
We're running out of time here, Ray. There's a lot more questions. We've been discussing this among ourselves, what we want to find out, and there's a lot to it. But there has been another drama going on in Washington, this conflict between the Senate Oversight Committee on the CIA and the CIA with Dianne Feinstein attacking the CIA as if she's a real CIA critic. Snowden attacking Dianne Feinstein as a hypocrite. You know, the director of the CIA basically saying, oh, no, we would never do anything like spy on the Senate. And, you know, this and the McClatchy newspaper is reporting, you know, that the White House has prevented documents about what actually went on in our torture program with being shared with the Senate. They're actually withholding this information while talking about cooperating with it. So it's what a web we weave here. Ray, what's your thought about this outbreak of anti-CIA criticism from an unlikely source, the woman who was actually defending the CIA?
Well, she's posturing. She's giving hypocrisy a bad name, Danny. For her to get up there and decry a violation of Fourth Amendment of the Constitution when she has blessed gross violations of the Fourth Amendment by NSA and everybody else, you know, it's a little too much. Now, I don't know exactly why she did that. I suspect that, you know, she had this grandma bear instinct when she saw her grandchildren on that staff being not only being abused by the CIA, but a crime report registered against them for stealing information that they weren't authorized to get. I think maybe she went off the deep end, but she's not going to win. You know why? Very simple. Obama fears John Brennan much more than he fears the likes of Dianne Feinstein. I've said before, I'll say again, it's very similar to what John Kennedy faced, and he paid dearly for it. Obama is afraid of our security services, afraid of what they can do to him, and he's not going to cross people like John Brennan or even the perjurer, James Clapper, head of National Intelligence, or he won't fire, he won't even disgrace any of these people who we know should be disgraced because he's too scared. And so I see this ending up in kind of like a beer summit, okay? He gets Brennan and he gets Dianne Feinstein and Joe Biden and they order some beer and maybe Feinstein will have wine, you know. And they say, "Oh, this is
they kiss
all
and make up." Mort, Les, yeah. Any point on this? We're running out of time on this segment. Yeah, any thought about this as you watched it play out in the media?
What I'm wondering is there any individual or grouping of individuals in the Ukraine that people here that actually you hope for the best for the democracy activists and do not want either segment of the kleptocratic elite to return to power? Is there anybody that you've been able to identify that we can attach our hopes to?
I don't know, Mort, and that's a function of my lack of detailed knowledge more than what the reality might be. My point would be that there must be a kind of a hole that we could cobble together with the Russians, because, you know, there is a shared interest here in not letting this thing blow out of proportions. And I hope that Obama can face down the neocons who are playing a bigger game here, because to the degree they create animosity between the Russians and us, then Syria, you know, then Syria goes back to where it was before we and the Russians will cooperate on Syria, and God knows what happens to Iran, because the Russians have been very helpful to the Iranians and to us to work out a sensible solution to that one. So putting all this in jeopardy, making Putin a very bad man, very bad man, very bad man, then the American people are not able to appreciate the subtleties of this thing and are not able to realize that we'll be sold down the road again by people who have objectives that are not what they seem.
Well, I can see why the President of the United States wanted you to come into the office every day and read the news to him, because you do such a good job of putting a human face on it and offering more context than we certainly get in the media. Ray McGovern, my hero from the fellow Bronxite and CIA turned anti-CIA activist. We have great respect and admiration for you. Thank you for joining us. In our next segment, we're going to hear more about Venezuela with Dr. Lee Salter from England, a media expert and author of quite a few articles about the Bolivarian Revolution and the media coverage of it. So stay with us here on Media Channel Radio on PRN FM. Lee Salter, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Lee. I'm sorry we're having some technical problems. We're converting the show into a MediaChannel.org a program, and there's some difficulty in doing that. I'm not sure what this background noise is, but let's try to move forward here. Your take, you know, three people were killed yesterday in Venezuela. Protests against the government are continuing. What's your take on the conflict that's underway right now from your vantage point as somebody who analyzes media coverage?
Well, I think that the conflict can't be understood as a conflict that started recently. I mean, this has been going on since 1998, since Chavez was first elected. And, you know, there's been a relentless campaign by the wealthier section of society that used to control all the major institutions and the oil company and so on and so forth to reverse the democratic decision of Venezuelans and try to overthrow the Bolivarian constitution.
I mean, this isn't a... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, most recently, you know, the claims are about declining standard of living or unavailability of toilet roll or, you know, various other claims. I mean, crime is a very serious issue out there, but I don't think those are the actual triggers for this. I mean, the actual triggers, you know, began in 1998.
And remind us, what happened then?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to put it a brief chronology, I mean, Chavez was elected in 98 in a free and fair election. By 2002, there was a coup that some analysts have suggested was backed by the U.S. The U.S. certainly has been giving money through the National Endowment for Democracy and other institutions to the so-called opposition. who are effectively the 5 or 10% of the population that used to control the economy. The coup was unsuccessful because although the military and the police and the major business sections of business were on side, the majority of people weren't. It was in particular the people in the barrios in the very poor areas who came down with their Bolivarian constitutions declaring the coup to be illegal and reversed it with the help of some of the presidential guards and some of the junior soldiers from around the country. This resulted in Chavez being put back into power, and since then there has been an ongoing campaign to get rid of him. The oil industry lockout, for example, in 2003 continued, and a constant pattern of attempts to destabilize the economy, to destabilize the currency, to destabilize the political system has not stopped. I mean, in the meantime, you know, free and fair elections have been held, and his party have won almost all of them. The only one they didn't win was a constitutional amendment, I think in 2010, which was going to reduce the limits on the number of terms a president can serve. They lost that, and that was the only one they've lost since.
Just your reaction to the suggestion, there have been these conspiracy rumors, which may have value or may have some validity, maybe not, you know, that somehow he was actually assassinated, you know, similar to what happened perhaps to Arafat, that his cancer somehow was injected into him. I don't know. Do you put any credence to that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, who knows at the end of the day? There's so much we don't know. But there are plenty of people who, you know, could be assassinated if they had the capacity, who are more of a threat than Chavez was. And also, I think, you know, that I would have thought anyone who would be wanting to do that would realize, you know, they would make a martyr out of him. And indeed, you know, he does live on. And this is a very, very important thing to bear in mind about Venezuela. And that's that although Chavez placed himself as this figurehead of this Bolivarian revolution, the real power of the Bolivarian revolution actually came from below. That pushed him up. But anyone who did want to assassinate him simply doesn't understand the situation in Venezuela. And indeed, that could be the case.
Well, if there is an assassin in America, I think our media might qualify for that designation in terms of the coverage. I wonder how it is in England.
Yeah.
You've been following the coverage. What do you see? Do you feel that it's fair reflection of what's going on or what's being left out?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, the coverage has been ridiculous in the main. But it's not, you know, very often when people talk about the media, they talk about bias. So they talk about, you know, journalists preferring this person or movement to that person or movement. What I've found in my research, and I looked at 10 years of coverage by the BBC, which is, of course, an important institution, to really understand the subtleties of the coverage. Because what I'd found initially was that out of 304 articles I looked at, only 3 of them mentioned anything slightly positive about Venezuela. And this wasn't because necessarily, in fact, it certainly wasn't because the correspondent didn't like Chavez or didn't like the Bolivarian Revolution. In fact, quite the opposite. When I first gave a talk about my research, the BBC correspondent was there and said it was extraordinary to hear me talking about his work because he actually admired and supported the Bolivarian Revolution. The point, however, is that, you know, news organizations see the world from a particular perspective. And that perspective is a kind of, with a small n, nationalist perspective, and a class-based perspective. I mean, in Britain, we call it middle class or upper middle class. I think you guys would call it ruling class or something, because it seems that everyone in America is somehow middle class. and that gives particular understandings, or lack of understanding, of how things happen. So what happens Venezuela is that they live in the very wealthy part of the town. That's where the BBC's apartment is that you have to go and live in. If you live in the wealthy part of town and you want to have anything resembling a normal life, you have to get on with those around you. So what tends to happen is that, you know, the journalists themselves are in a particular milieu. Okay, they're not in the barrios, they're not talking to those people every day, they're talking to wealthy Venezuelans every day. The journalists on the ground in Venezuela who feed the international news agencies like Reuters and Associated Press and so on are themselves working in the Venezuelan media the rest of their time, which are themselves controlled by...
We're having a few technical issues here, but, you know, I hear what you're saying. It's sort of a class... reporting, looking to report on itself as opposed to reporting on what's really happening here. Mort, your thoughts on the coverage that you've been watching and monitoring?
In the Western press, by definition, inevitably, they're going to be interviewing people who speak the English language. Venezuela, at large, have a great deal of familial wealth and or have been educated in the English language. They are the ones that are able to communicate a message to an English-speaking audience. And more often than not, that segment of the population is going to be antagonistic to the Bolivarian Revolution, more often than not. So I think we're talking about cheap coverage. I don't know whether we still have Lee with us, but I wanted to ask Lee, domestically in Venezuela, right around the time of the Chavez coup, I remember the story of Globovision airing telenovelas when his supporters were taking the streets trying to return him to power. And since then, Globovision has been sold, and there's been a lot of changes of ownership in Venezuela's domestic media. And I'd like to ask you if you could talk a little bit about how that landscape has changed between the state-owned institutions and the privately held institutions, and Venezuelans getting from their media of all political strata.
I think, you know, to mention the coup, actually, I mean, it was very interesting to talk to the BBC correspondents because they said that was the one thing that they had no problem with, in my analysis, because they said they had nobody there. So they were entirely dependent on the private media for all of the information that fed out to them. So they got everything wrong. It was absolutely absurd. In terms of the changes, though, I mean, I think in some respects I can understand why the government has clamped down as they have. I mean, if in the UK the BBC supported a coup to overthrow the current Prime Minister David Cameron, they would lose their license. The presenters would probably be arrested for incitement or terrorist offences under the Terrorism Act and so on. I think any state that's facing an armed insurrection will have to face off the media, especially if they're backing it. So I understand that. I think perhaps with media plurality in terms of the content, it's gone a bit too far. I think it's very interesting to think about the amount of money that the government's given to community media projects, and those for me are the most important ones. I've visited a few of them in the barrios in Caracas, you know, where ordinary people living in the barrios are able to have their radio stations, magazines, bookshops, and articulate their experiences to other Venezuelans. It's also the case, and this is really crucial to remember, that the right wing out there, you know, who control the media, and in particular the distribution of newspapers, refuse very often, historically, to carry any left-wing magazines and newspapers. I visited the office of one magazine where they said they hadn't been able to sell any on the newsstands. They drop them off. When they come back, they're still sealed in cellophane wrapping because the news agents have been instructed not to sell them. So the media situation out there is very, very complicated, I think. And you know, in some respects, there's some better media coverage now within the country, but I think they also do need to facilitate the voices of those reactionary right-wing forces, of course.
And your take of speaking to journalists or people in Venezuela about how they see what they're doing, you know, was the media there controlled? Was there freedom to criticize the government? And is there today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most significant change has been in terms of allowing the government to have a say. Now, look, I mean, the situation before was absolutely awful because there was almost nothing that the government could actually get out into the public sphere, because the media was just basically censoring the government. So Chavez introduced this compulsory coverage of his some of his speeches and so on and so forth. They introduced Telesur, which is the kind of attempt at a Bolivarian version of CNN. So, you know, there has been an increase in plurality of people who support, in terms of people who support the government. They've actually got a bigger voice than they had. But there's no, you know, clampdown as you might read in the media or see on the TV. There's no journalists being rounded up. There's no newspapers being closed down because of their content as such. There are investigations into financial irregularities like there are anywhere. You know, the former owner of the Daily Telegraph in this country, Conrad Black, who's was actually a Canadian citizen, was arrested and imprisoned for financial irregularities. So, you know, I think we can see similar things that are happening in any other developed Western nation.
You know, in the case of a clampdown, there seems to be a clampdown here in terms of coverage that doesn't simply reflect the opposition good, government bad narrative. And we've seen this a great deal in the coverage of Nicaragua. And I've just read, for example, Z Magazine, ZNet, basically criticizing the left media in this country for not really covering what's happening in Venezuela, covering Maduro, covering the conflicts there. In fact, Maduro was just interviewed by Christian Annapour, which was sort of a breakthrough to get his voice anyway out in the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, that level of it is ridiculous. I mean, you know, the best I can say about Britain and Europe is you know, their focusing on the Ukraine instead. If that weren't happening, then I would have thought absolutely there would be exaggerated claims of hundreds of people massacred on the streets and so on and so forth. No, I mean, there's almost no coverage of any government supporters' murders. Okay, you know, they're being killed as well. I mean, that much is known. There's no real coverage of the people who are suffering because of the protests or anything like this. None of those concerns are articulated. Now, what's really interesting, and I must get this out because I wonder how many of your listeners knew about this, that we had some riots in 2011 in this country. They spread from London all over the country. And during the riots, there were four kids, 17, 18-year-old kids, who wrote on Facebook, should we go and have some fun in town, or let's have a riot in town? Nothing happened. There was no riots, no disturbance, no nothing as a result of these kids writing on Facebook. The four kids each got 4 years in prison for writing that on Facebook. Now, there's no international media campaign about media repression in England. Human Rights Watch didn't come in. The United Nations didn't parachute French peacekeepers to defend, you know, these kids. That gets completely blocked out. But as soon as you get a disturbance in an enemy country, then, of course, you know, the discourse is completely different.
And your view about what are the key points about all this that seem to be missed that you're noticing, Mort, in terms of coverage of Venezuela, just the actual factual information about what the different positions of the parties there are, of the government, of the opposition. It seems to be one opposition leader is getting a tremendous amount of press. You know, even a visit that he made to Norway seemed to get attention. But it's hard to find out what the government is actually saying and doing. What is your sense, Mort?
I mean, my sense is a list of questions a mile long. I honestly, living in New York and having limited access to the media that we have, I don't know whether to make heads or tails or anything. My sympathies lie with the solution. And I get the endless litany of, it's the violence, it's the inflation, it's the scarcity of consumer staples, it's the toilet paper. What is your sense of the legitimacy of those issues? Take them one at a time if you want, Lee. What is the basis for this present unrest? Is it just totally trumped up and just a new bow on the same anti-democratic forces that have existed since the election of Chavez, or have things changed in the country vis-a-vis the popular support of the Bolivarian Revolution and these problems for Maduro?
Okay, I think there are certainly, without doubt, some issues with the speed and depth of the Bolivarian Revolution. Not enough's happened. You know, crime is still a problem. Corruption is still a problem. There are genuine problems with the distribution of goods and so on and so forth. You know, that is without a doubt. The degree to which those are problems caused by the government is questionable. Of course, this economic sabotage has been going on since 1998. You know, the idea of crime, I mean, you know, crime rates have gone up. Whether that's because there's more reporting or there's more policing or what, we don't know. We will never know. But again, you know, the fact that there are very high crime rates in Venezuela speaks much more of the previous 50 years of mismanagement, social exclusion, marginalization of the majority. You know, the people who are, you know, rising up now, as it were, they never rose up during the Caracazo massacre, where thousands of people were slaughtered for the International Monetary Fund. They never rose up to protest about the living standards of the 80% of Venezuelans who are living in poverty. You know, they never rose up under these circumstances. What they're doing now is that they're getting very annoyed because their own living standards, their own expectations of being able to rule because they ought to rule, because that's who they are, has been threatened and is not going away. So I see this much more as a continuation rather than
isn't there
a response to very specific changes.
Isn't there another side to this, and we're going to have to wrap this up now, you know, that there were positive achievements of this revolution in terms of poverty alleviation, distribution of resources, education, health care, all of these things that Americans certainly and perhaps people there have no idea about, that have actually been achieved as opposed to, you know, developments in other so-called third world countries?
Absolutely. And, you know, the best place to look for information on that, ironically, is the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, because they collect data on the state of the economy and society and so on and so forth. And it's absolutely incredible to see that the World Bank, when it's measuring economic performance during the economic crisis, is quite clear. You can look at the graphs online right now and you will see the Venezuelan economy has actually been quite resilient, much more so than, say, the Greek or even the British economy.
Or possibly even the American.
Rates, women in parliament. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And then literacy rates, and then you know, the number of people going to school, the number of females who are actually gaining political representation, all of these changes, of course, are completely ignored by the Western corporate media.
Well, Lee Salter, thank you so much for joining us. Sorry for the technical problems. I don't know if you've experienced the ones we've experienced, but thank you for coming in. We'd love to come back to you at some point and talk some more about your media analysis and the work that you've done and are doing to enlighten the public about the role the media is playing, what's being covered, what's not being covered. Mort of MediaChannel.org, thank you as well. I'm sorry for the difficulties that we've had in communicating here. We're on at this time, 5 p.m. on Thursdays on PRN.fm. Please join us. This program will be in the podcast. And MediaChannel.org is continuing to cover what's happening in the coverage of Venezuela, of the Ukraine, and elsewhere. So thank you for listening and being part of it. You can write to me at dissector@MediaChannel.org. Thank you again, PRN, for carrying this program.